Inigo's first dream. When Ediard awoke, his dream was already a confused, fading memory. The same thing happened every morning. No matter how hard he tried, he never could hold on to the images and sounds afflicting him every night. Akeem said not to worry. His dreams were made from the gentle spillage of other sleeping minds around him. Ediard did not believe that the things he dreamed of came from anywhere like their village. The fragments he occasionally managed to cling to were too strange and fascinating for that. Cool pre-dawn light was showing up the cracks in the window's wooden shutters. Ediard lay still for a while, cozy under the pile of blankets that covered his cot. It was a big room with whitewashed plaster walls and bare floorboards. The rafters of the hammerbeam roof above were ancient Martos wood that had blackened and hardened over the decades until they resembled iron. There was not much by way of furniture. Two-thirds of the floor space was completely empty. Ediard had shoved what was left down to the end that had a broad window. At the foot of the cot was a crude chest where he kept his meagre collection of clothes. There was a long table covered in his enthusiastic sketches of possible genistar animals, several chairs, and a dresser with a plain white bowl and a pitcher of water. Over in the corner opposite the cot, the fire had burned out sometime in the night, with a few embers left glimmering in the grate. It was difficult to heat such a large volume, especially in winter, and Ediard could see his breath as a fine white mist. Technically, he lived in the apprentice dormitory of Ashwell Village's Eggshaper Guild, but he was the only occupant. He had lived there for the last 6 years, ever since his parents had died when he was 8 years old. Master Akeem, the village's sole remaining shaper, had taken him in after the caravan they had joined to travel through the hills to the east had been attacked by bandits. Ediard wrapped a blanket around his shoulders and hurried over the cold floor to the small brick arch fireplace. The embers still were giving off a little heat, warming the clothes he had left on the back of a chair. He dressed hurriedly, pulling up badly worn leather trousers and tucking an equally worn shirt into the waist before struggling into a thick green sweater. As always, the fabric smelled of the stables and their varied occupants, a mélange of fur and food and cages, but after 6 years at the guild he was so used to it that he hardly noticed. He sat back on the cot to pull his boots on. They really were too small for him now. With the last 18 months, seeing more genistars in the stables and Ediard taking on official commission duties, their little branch of the Eggshaper Guild had seen a lot more money coming in. Hardly a fortune, but sufficient to pay for new clothes and boots. It was just that he never had time to visit the cobbler. He winced slightly as he stood up, trying to wriggle his toes, which were squashed together. It was no good. He definitely was going to take an hour out of his busy day to visit the cobbler. He grinned. But not today. Today was when the village's new well would be finished. It was a project in which the Eggshaper Guild was playing an unusually large part. Better than that, for him it was an innovative part. Ediard knew how many doubters there were in the village, basically everybody, but Master Akeem had quietly persuaded the Elder Council to give his young apprentice a chance. They had said yes, only because they had nothing to lose. He made his way downstairs, then hurried across the narrow rear yard to the warmth of the guild dining hall. Like the dormitory, it was a sharp reminder that the Eggshaper Guild had known better times, a lot better. There were still two rows of long bench tables in the big hall, enough to seat 50 shapers and their guests on feast nights. At the far end, the huge fireplace had iron baking ovens built into the stonework on either side, and the roasting spit was large enough to handle a whole pig. This morning, the fire was just a small blaze tended by a couple of G-monkeys. Normally, people did not let the genistars get anywhere near naked flames. They were as skittish as any terrestrial animal. But Ediard's orders were lucid and embedded deeply enough that the G-monkeys could manage the routine without panicking. Ediard sat at the table closest to the fire. His mind directed a batch of instructions to the G-monkeys by using simple telepathic long talk. He used a pigeon version of Querentia's mental language, visualizing the sequence of events he wanted in conjunction with simple command phrases, making sure that the emotional content was zero. So many people forgot that, and then could not understand why the Genistars did not obey properly. The G-monkeys started scurrying around. They were big creatures, easily the weight of a full-grown human male, with six long legs along the lower half of the body, and six even longer arms on top, the first two pairs so close together that they seemed to be sharing a shoulder joint, while the third pair was set farther back along a very flexible spine. Their bodies were covered in a wiry white fur, with patches worn away on joints and palms to reveal a leathery cinder-coloured hide. The head profile was the same as in all the Genistar variants, a plain globe with a snout very close to that of a terrestrial dog. The ears were situated on the lower part of the head, back toward the stumpy neck, each one sprouting three petals of long, creased skin thin enough to be translucent. A big mug of tea was placed in front of Ediard, swiftly followed by thick slices of toast, a bowl of fruit, and a plate of scrambled eggs. He tucked in heartily enough, already running through the critical part of the day's operation at the bottom of the well. His farsight picked up Akeem when the old man was still in the lodge, the residence for senior shapers annexed to the hall. Ediard already could perceive, through a couple of stone walls, sensing physical structures as if they were shadows, while minds buzzed with an iridescent glow. That vision was of a caliber that eluded a lot of adults. It made Akeem inordinately proud of his apprentice's ability, claiming his own training was the true key to developing Ediard's potential. The old shaper came into the hall to find the G-monkeys ready with his breakfast. He grunted favourably as he gave Ediard's shoulder a paternal squeeze. "Do you sense me getting up in my bedroom, boy?" he asked, gesturing at his waiting plate of sausage and tomato.
"No, sir," Ediard said happily. "Can't manage to get through four walls yet."
"Won't be long," Akeem said as he lifted his tea. "The way you're developing, I'll be sleeping outside the village walls by midsummer. Everyone's entitled to some privacy."
"I would never intrude," Ediard protested.
He mellowed and grinned sheepishly as he caught the amusement in the old shaper's mind. Master Akeem had passed his 180th birthday several years back, so he claimed, though he was always vague about the precise year that had happened. Life expectancy on Querentia was supposed to be around 200 years, though Ediard did not know of anyone in Ashwell or the surrounding villages who actually had managed to live that long. However, Akeem's undeniable age had given him a rounded face with at least three chins rolling back into a thick neck. A lacework of red and purple capillaries decorated the pale skin of his cheeks and nose, producing a terribly wan appearance. The thin stubble left behind after his perfunctory daily shave was now mostly grey, which didn't help the careworn impression everyone received on seeing him for the first time. Once a week, the old man used the same razor on what was left of his silver hair. Despite his declining years, he always insisted on dressing smartly. His personal G-monkeys were well-versed in laundry work. Today his tailored leather trousers were clean, his boots polished, a pale yellow shirt washed and pressed. He wore a jacket woven from magenta and jade yarn with the egg in a twisted circle crest of the Egg-Shaper Guild on the lapel. The jacket might not be as impressive as the robes worn by guild members in Makathran, but in Ashwell it was a symbol of prestige, earning him respect. None of the other village elders dressed as well. Ediard sheepishly realized he was fingering his own junior apprentice badge, a simple metal button on his collar. The emblem was similar to Akeem's, but with only a quarter circle. Half the time he forgot to pin it on in the morning. After all, nobody showed him any respect, ever. But if all went well today, he would be entitled to a badge with half a circle. Akeem said he could never remember anyone attempting a shaping so sophisticated for a senior apprentice assessment.
"Nervous?" the old man asked.
"No,"
Ediard said immediately. Then he ducked his head. "They work in the tank, anyway."
"Of course they do. They always do. Our true skill comes in determining what works in real life. From what I've seen, I don't believe there will be a problem. That's not a guarantee, mind. Nothing in life is certain."
"What did you shape for your senior apprentice assessment?" Ediard asked.
"Ah, now, well, that was a long time ago. Things were different back then, more formal. They always are in the capital. I suspect they haven't changed much.
Akeem, Ediard pleaded. He loved the old man dearly, but oh, how his mind wandered these days.
Yes, yes. As I recall, the assessment required 4G spiders, functional ones, mind. They had to spin dross silk at the Grand Master's presentation, so everyone wound up shaping at least 6 or 7 to be safe. We also had to shape a wolf, a chimp, and an eagle.
Ah, he sighed. They were hard days. I remember my master used to beat me continually, and the larks we used to get up to in the dormitory at night.
Ediard was slightly disappointed. But I can do G-spiders and all the rest.
I know, Akeem said proudly, and patted the boy's hand. But we both know how gifted you are. A junior apprentice is normally 17 before taking the kind of assessment you're getting today, and then a lot of them fail the first time. This is why I've made your task all the harder. A reshaped form that works is the standard graduation from apprenticehood to practitioner.
It is?
Oh, yes. Of course, I've been dreadfully remiss in the rest of the guild's teachings. It was hard enough to make you sit down long enough to learn your letters. And you're really not old enough to take in the guild ethics and all that boring old theory. No matter how precise they are when I gift them to you, though you seem to grasp things at an instinctive level. That's why you're still only going to be an apprentice after this.
Ediard frowned. What kind of ethics could be involved in shaping?
Can't you think?
No, not really. Genistars are such a boon. They help everyone. Now that I'm helping you sculpt, we can produce more standard genera than before. The village will grow strong and rich again.
Well, I suppose, as you're due to become a senior apprentice, we should start to consider these notions. We'd need more apprentices, if that were to truly come about.
The Sansia and little Evox has powerful long talk.
We'll see. Who knows? We might prove a little more acceptable after today. Families are reluctant to offer their children for us to train. And your friend Oberon doesn't help matters.
Ediard flushed. Oberon was the village's chief bully, a boy a couple of years older than he who delighted in making Ediard's life a misery outside the walls of the guild compound. He hadn't realized Akeem had known about that.
I should take care of him.
The lady knows you've had enough provocation of late. I'm proud you haven't struck back. Egg-shapers are always naturally strong telepaths. But part of that ethics course you're missing is how we shouldn't abuse our advantage.
I just haven't because...
He shrugged.
It's not the right thing to do, and you know that,
Akeem concluded.
You're a good boy, Ediard.
The old man looked at him, his thoughts a powerful mixture of pride and sadness. Proximity to emotional turmoil made Ediard blink away the water unexpectedly springing into his eyes. He shook his head as if to disentangle himself from the old man's mind.
Did you ever have someone like Oberon ragging you when you were an apprentice?
Let's just say, one of the reasons I came to stay in Ashwell was because my interpretation of our guild ethics differed from that of the Master of the Blue Tower. And please remember, although I am your master and tutor, I also require guild standards to be fulfilled. If I judge you lacking, you will not get your senior apprentice badge today. That includes taking care of your ordinary duties.
Ediard pushed his empty plate away and downed the last of his tea.
I'd better get to it then, Master.
I also fail anyone who shows disrespect.
Ediard pulled on a woolly hat against the chilly air and went out into the guild compound's main courtyard. It was unusual in that it had 9 sides, 7 made of stable blocks, then a large barn and the hatchery. None of them was the same size or height. When he first had moved in, Ediard had been impressed. The Eggshaper Guild compound was the largest collection of buildings in the village. To someone who had been brought up in a small cottage with a leaky thatch roof, it was a palatial castle. Back then, he'd never noticed the deep cloak of chymos, staining every roof a vivid purple, or how pervasive and tangled the gurk vine was, covering the dark stone walls of the courtyard with its ragged, pale yellow leaves,
while its roots wormed their way into the mortar between the blocks, weakening the structure. This morning he just sighed at the sight, wondering if he'd ever get around to directing the G-monkeys on a clean-up mission. This would be a good time. The gurk vine leaves had all fallen to gather in the corners of the courtyard in great mouldering piles, and the moss was soaking up the season's moisture, turning into great spongy mats that would be easy to peel off. Like everything else in his life, it would have to wait. If only Akim could find another apprentice, he thought wistfully. We spend our whole lives running to catch up. Just one extra person in the guild would make so much difference. It would take a miracle granted by the lady, he acknowledged grudgingly. The village families were reluctant to allow their children to train at the Eggshaper Guild. They appreciated how dependent they were on Genistars, but they couldn't afford to lose able hands. The guild was just like the rest of Ashwell, struggling to keep going. Ediard hurried across the courtyard to the tanks where his new, reshaped cats were kept, silently asking the lady why he bothered to stay in this backward place on the edge of the wilds. To his right were the largest stables, where the defaults shuffled around their stalls. They were simple beasts, unshaped, egg-laying genistars, the same size as terrestrial ponies, with six legs supporting a bulbous body. The six upper limbs were vestigial, producing bumps along the creature's back. In the female, over 30% of the internal organs were ovaries, producing an egg every 15 days. The males, of which there were three, lumbered around in a big pen at one end, and the females were kept in a row of 15 separate stalls. For the first time since Akim had taken him in, the stalls were all occupied. That was a source of considerable satisfaction to Ediard. Not even a master as accomplished as Akim, and despite his age, he was a singular talent, could manage 15 defaults by himself. Shaping an egg took a long time, and Ediard had had as many grotesque failures as he'd had successes. First of all, the timing had to be right. An egg needed to be shaped no earlier than 10 hours after fertilization, and no later than 25. How long it took depended on the nature of the genus required. Ediard often had spent half the night sitting in a stall's deep, cushioned shaper chair with his mind focused on the egg. Egg shaping, as Akim so often had described it, was like sculpting intangible clay with invisible hands. The ability was a gentle combination of farsight and telekinesis. His mind could see inside the egg, and only those who could do that with perfect clarity could become shapers. Not that he liked to boast, but Ediard's mental vision was the most acute in the village. What he saw within the shell was like a small exemplar of a default genistar made of grey shadow substance. His telekinesis would reach out and begin to shape it into the form he wanted, but slowly, so frustratingly slowly. There were limits. He could not give a genistar anything extra. 7 arms. 2 heads. What the process did was activate the nascent structures inherent within the default physiology. He also could define size, though that was determined partially by what type of genus he was shaping. Then there were subfamilies within each standard genus. Chimps, as well as monkeys. A multitude of horse types. Big, small, powerful, fast, slow. A long list that had to be memorized perfectly. Shaping was inordinately difficult, requiring immense concentration. Shapers had to have a lot more than eldritch vision and manipulation. They had to have the feel of what they were doing, know instinctively if what they were doing was right, see potential in the embryonic genistar. In the smaller creatures there would be no room for reproductive organs, so they had to be disengaged. Other organs, too, had to be selected where appropriate. But which ones? Small wonder even a grand master produced a large percentage of invalid eggs. Ediard walked past the default stables, his farsight flashing through the building, checking that the G-monkeys were getting on with their jobs of mucking out and feeding. Several were becoming negligent and disorderly, so he refreshed their instructions with a quick, long-talk message. A slightly deeper scan with his farsight showed him the state of the gestating eggs inside the defaults. Of the 11 that had been shaped, 3 were showing signs that indicated that problems were developing. He gave a resigned sigh. Two of them were his. After the defaults came the horse stables. There were 9 foals currently accommodated, 7 of which were growing up into large, sturdy brutes that would pull ploughs and carts on the surrounding farms. Most of the commissions given to Ashwell's Eggshaper Guild were for genistars that could be used in agriculture. The custom of using domestic G-monkeys and chimps was in decline. Ediard knew that had happened because people didn't take the time to learn how to instruct them properly. Not that they were going to come here and take lessons from a 14-year-old boy. It annoyed him immensely. He was certain the village economy could be improved 4-fold at least if they just listened to him.
Patience, Akeem always counseled when he raged against the short-sighted fools who were their neighbours. Often to do what's right, you first have to do what's wrong. There will come a time when your words will be heeded.
Ediard didn't know when that would be. Even if today he was successful, he did not expect a rush of people to congratulate him and seek his advice. He was sure he was destined to remain forever the freaky boy who lived alone with batty old Akeem. A well-matched pair, they all said when they thought he couldn't far sight them. The monkey and chimp pen was on the other side of the horses. It had only a couple of infant monkeys inside, curled up in their nest. The rest were all out and about, performing their duties around the guild compound. They didn't have any commissions for G-monkeys on their books. Even the smithy who worked 5 did not want any extras. Perhaps I should bring people to the guild buildings, Ediard thought. Show them what the G-monkeys can do if they're ordered correctly. Or Akeem could show them, at least. Just something that would break the cycle, make people more adventurous. The freaky boys' daydream. After the monkey pen came the kennels. G-dogs remained in high demand, especially the kind used for herding cattle and sheep. 8 pups were nursing from the 2 milk bitches he'd shaped himself. They allowed the defaults to go straight back to egg production without an extended nursing period. It had taken 12 invalid eggs before he had succeeded in shaping the first. The innovation was one he had introduced after reading about the milk bitch in an ancient guild text. Now he was keen to try to extend it across all the genistar types. Akeem had been supportive when the first one had hatched, impressed as much by Ediard's tenacity as by his shaping skill. The compound's main gateway was wedged between the dog kennels and the wolf kennels. There were 6 of the fierce creatures maturing. Always useful outside the village walls, the wolves were deployed as guards for Ashwell and all its outlying farmhouses. They also were taken on hunts through the forests, helping to clear out Quarencia's native predators, as well as the occasional bandit group. Ediard stopped and looked in. The G-wolves were lean creatures with dark grey fur that blended in with most landscapes. Their long snouts were equipped with sharp fangs that could bite clean through a medium-sized branch, let alone a limb of meat and bone. The large pups mewled excitedly as he hung over the door and patted them. His hand was licked by hot, serpentine tongues. 2 of them had a pair of arms. It was another of his innovations. He wanted to see if they could carry knives or clubs. That was something else he had found in an old text, another idea the villagers had shaken their heads in despair at. Out of the whole courtyard he liked the aviary best. It was a squat circular coat with arched openings 20 feet above the ground, just below the eaves. There was a single doorway at the base. Inside, the open space was crisscrossed by broad matos beams. Over the years, the wood had been heavily scarred by talons, so much so that the original square cut was now rounded out on top. There was only a single G-eagle left, as big as Ediard's torso. The bird had a double-wing arrangement, with 2 limbs supporting the large front wing and giving it remarkable flexibility. The rear wing was a simple triangle for stability. Its gold and emerald feathers cloaked a streamlined body with a long, slender jaw, where the teeth had merged into a single serrated edge very similar to a beak. Tri-segment eyes blinked down at Ediard as he smiled up. He so envied the G-Eagle, how it could soar free and clear of the village and all its earthbound drudgery and irrelevance. It had an unusually strong telepathic ability, allowing Ediard to experience wings spread wide and the wind slipping past. Often whole afternoons would pass, with an enthralled Ediard twinned with the G-Eagle's mind as it swooped and glided over the forests and valleys outside, providing an intoxicating taste of the freedom that existed beyond the village. It rustled its wings, enthused by Ediard's appearance and the prospect of flight. "Not yet," Ediard had to tell it reluctantly. Its snout was shaken in disgust, and the eyes shut, returning it to an aloof posture. The hatchery came between the aviary and the cattery. It was a low circular building, like a half-size aviary. Its broad iron-bound wooden door was closed and bolted. It was the one place in the compound where G-monkeys were not permitted to go. Ediard had the task of keeping it clean and tidy. A sheltered stone shelf to the right of the door had 9 thick candles alight, traditionally one for each egg inside. He swept his farsight across them all, happy to confirm that the embryos were growing satisfactorily. After they had been laid, the eggs took about 10 days to hatch, cosseted in cradles that, in winter months, were warmed by slowly smouldering charcoal in a massive iron stove. He would have to rake out the ashes and add some more lumps before midday. One of the eggs was due to hatch tomorrow, he judged. Another horse. Finally, he went into the cattery, the smallest of the buildings, walling the courtyard. Standard Genistar cats were small semi-aquatic creatures with dark, oily fur and broad, webbed feet, devoid of upper limbs. Guild convention had them as one of the 7 standard genera, though nobody outside the capital, Makatran, ever found much use for them. It was the gondoliers who kept a couple on each boat, using them to keep the city's canals clean of weeds and rodents. The cattery was a rectangular room, taken up by knee-high stone tables. Light came in through windows set into the roof. As a testament to how prolifically the Kaimos had spread, Ediard now always supplemented his ordinary sight with farsight as he shuffled along the narrow aisles between the tables. From inside, the windows had been reduced to narrow slits that provided a meager amethyst radiance. Glass tanks sat along the tables. They were ancient basins the size of bulky coffins, dating back to when the whole compound had been built. Half of them had cracked sides, with dried and dead algae staining the glass. The bottoms were filled with gravel and desiccated flakes of mud. Ediard had refurbished 5 to hold his reshaped cats, with another 3 modified to act as crude reservoirs. The pipes he used to test their ability were strewn across the floor in a tangled mess. All 5 reshaped cats lay on the gravel bed of the tanks, with just a few inches of water rippling sluggishly around them. They resembled fat lozenges of glistening ebony flesh, half the size of a human. There were no limbs of any kind, just a row of 6 circular gills along their flanks dangling loose tubes of thick skin. The head was so small, it looked undeveloped to the point of being misshapen. There were no eyes or ears. It was all Ediard's farsight could do to detect any sparkle of thought within the tiny brain. He grinned down cheerily at the unmoving lumps, searching through them for any sign of malady. When he was satisfied that their health was as good as possible, he stood perfectly still, taking calm, measured breaths the way Akim had taught him. He focused his telekinesis, the third hand, as most villagers called it, on the first cat. He could feel the black flesh within his incorporeal grip and lifted it off the bed of mucky gravel. Half an hour later, when Baraka, the village cartwright, drove his wagon into the courtyard, he found Ediard and Akim standing beside 5 tarpaulins, with the reshaped cats lying on them. He wrinkled his face in disgust at the bizarre creatures and shot the old guildmaster a questioning look. "Are you sure about this?" he asked as he swung himself off the bench. The cartwright was a squat man, made even broader by 8 decades of hard physical labour. He had a thick, unruly ginger beard that made his grey eyes seem even more sunken. His hand scratched at his buried chin as he surveyed the G-cats, doubt swirling openly in his mind for Ediard to see. Baraka didn't care much about the feelings of young apprentices. "If they work, they will bring a large benefit to Ashwell. Hakim said smoothly. Surely it's worth a try. Whatever you say, Baraka conceded. He gave Ediard a sly grin. Are you aiming to be our mayor, boy? If this works, you'll get my blessing. I've been washing in horse muck these last 3 months. Cause old Gipalt will have his nose right out of joint. Gipalt, the village carpenter, was in charge of the existing well's pump, and by rights should have built a new pump for the freshly dug well. He was the chief naysayer on allowing Ediard to try his innovation. It didn't help that Oberon was his apprentice. There are worse things in life than an annoyed Gipalt, Hakim said. Besides, when this works, he'll have more time for profitable commissions. Baraka laughed. You old rogue. It is your tongue, not your mind, which shapes words against their true meaning. Hakim gave a small, pleased bow. Thank you. Shall we begin loading? If Melzar's team is ready, Baraka said. Ediard's farsight flashed out, surveying the new well and the crowd gathering around it. They are. Weddard has called the G-Monkey digging team out. Baraka gave him a calculating stare. The new well was being dug on the other side of the village from the Eggshaper Guild compound. His own farsight could not reach that far. Very well. We'll put them on the wagon. Can you manage a third of the weight, boy? Ediard was very pleased that he managed to stop any irony from showing amid his surface thoughts. I think so, sir. He caught Hakim's small private smile. The master's mind remained calm and demure. Baraka gave the reshaped cats another doubting look and scratched his beard once more. All right, then. On my call. 3, 2, 1. Ediard exerted his third hand, careful not to boost more than he was supposed to. With the three of them lifting, the reshaped cat rose smoothly into the air and floated into the back of the open wagon. They're not small, are they? Baraka said. His smile was somewhat forced. Good thing you're helping, Hakim. Ediard did not know if he should protest or laugh. We all play our part, Hakim said, giving Ediard a warning stare. Second one, then, Baraka said. 10 minutes later, they were rolling through the village, Baraka and Hakim sitting on the wagon's bench while Ediard made do with the rear, one arm resting protectively over a cat. Ashwell was a cluster of buildings in the lee of a modest stone cliff that had sheared out of the side of a gentle slope. Almost impossible to climb, the cliff formed a good defence, with a semicircular walled rampart of earth and stone completing their protection from any malign forces that might ride in from the wild lands to the northeast. Most of the buildings were simple stone cottages with thatch roofs and slatted shutters. Some larger buildings had windows with glass panes that had been brought in from the western towns. Only the broad main street, running parallel to the cliff, was cobbled. The lanes running off it were little more than muddy ruts, worn down to stone by wheels and feet. Although the Eggshaper compound was the biggest collection of buildings, the tallest was the Church of the Empyrean Lady, with its conical spire rising out of the north side of the low dome. Once upon a time the stone church had been a uniform white, but many seasons of neglect had seen the lightest sections moulder to a drab grey, with chymos pullulating in the slim gaps between the big blocks. The road down to the village gate branched off midway along the main street. Ediard looked along it, seeing the short brick-lined tunnel that cut through the sloping rampart. At the far end, the massive doors were open to the outside world. On the top of the wall, twin watchtowers stood on either side of the door, with big iron bells on top. They would be rung by the guards at any sign of trouble approaching. Ediard had never heard them. Some of the older villagers claimed to remember their sound when bandit gangs had been spotted crossing the farmlands, bordering the village. As Ediard looked at the top of the rampart wall, with its uneven line and many different materials, he wondered how hard it actually would be to overcome their fortifications. There were places where crumbling gaps had been plugged by thick timbers, which themselves were rotting beneath swaths of chymos. Even if every man and woman in the village carried arms, they could not stretch along more than a third of the length. In reality, their safety depended on the illusion of strength. A sharp prick of pain in his left shin made him wince. It was a telekinetic pinch, which he warded off with a strong shield over his flesh. Obron and two of his cronies were flanking the wagon, mingling with the other villagers who were heading up to the new well. There was a sense of carnival in the air as the wagon made its slow procession through Ashwell, with people abandoning their normal work to tag along and see the innovation. Now that Ediard had been jerked away from his daydreaming, he picked up on the bustle of amusement and interest, filling the ether through the village. Very few people were expecting his reshaped cats to work, but they were looking forward to witnessing the failure. Typical, he thought. This village always expects the worst. It's exactly the attitude that's responsible for our decline. Not everything can be blamed on bad weather, poor crops, and more bandits.
"Hey, egg boy!" Obron jeered. "What are those abortions? And where are your pump genistars?"
He laughed derisively, a cackling that quickly was duplicated by his friends.
"These are..."
Ediard began crossly. He stopped as their laughter rose, wishing the wagon could travel faster. There were smiles on the faces of the adults walking alongside as they witnessed typical apprentice rivalry, remembering what it had been like when they were young. Obron's thoughts were vivid and mocking. Ediard managed to keep his temper. Revenge would come as soon as the cats were in place. There would be respect for the Eggshaper Guild, with a corresponding loss of status for the carpenters. He was clinging smugly to that knowledge when the wagon rolled up beside the new well. It had been 4 months since the village's old well had collapsed partially. Rubble and silt had been sucked up into the pump, a large contraption assembled by the Carpentry Guild, with big cogwheels and leather bladders that were compressed and expanded by 3 G-horses harnessed to a broad axle wheel. They walked around and around in a circle all day long, producing gulps of water that slopped out of the pipe into a reservoir trough for everyone to use. As no one had noticed the sludge at first, the G-horses kept walking until the pump started to creak and shudder. It had been badly damaged. Once the extent of the damage to the well had been assessed, the Elder Council had decreed that a new well should be dug. This time it was at the top of the village, close to the cliff where the water percolating down from the slopes above should be plentiful. There were also ideas that a simple network of pipes could carry fresh water into each house. That would have required an even larger pump to be built. At that point, Akim had brought his apprentice's idea to the council. The crowd that had gathered around the head of the new well was good-natured enough when the wagon stopped. Melzar, who listed Watermaster, among many other village titles, was standing beside the open hole, talking to Weddard, the stonemason who had overseen the team of G-monkeys that had performed the actual digging. They both gave the reshaped cats an intrigued look. Ediard was not really aware of them. He could hear a lot of sniggering. It came mostly from the gang of apprentices, centered on Obron. His cheeks flushed red as he struggled to keep the anger from showing in his surface thoughts. "Have faith in yourself," someone whispered into his mind, a skillfully directed long-talk voice directed at him alone. The sentiment was threaded with a rosy glow of approval. He looked around to see Salrana smiling warmly at him. She was only 12, dressed in the blue and white robe of a lady's novice. A sweet, good-natured child, she had never wanted to do anything other than join the church. The lady's mother of Ashwell, Lorelin, had been happy to start her instructions. Attendance was never high in the village church, apart from the usual festival services. Like Ediard, Salrana never quite fit into the mainstream of village life. It made them feel kindred. She was like a younger sister. He grinned back at her as he clambered down from the wagon. Lorelin, who was standing protectively to one side of her, gave him a bland smile. Melzar came over to the back of the wagon.
"This should be interesting."
"Why, thank you," Akim said. The cold air was turning the blood vessels on his nose and cheeks an even darker shade than normal. Melzar inclined his head surreptitiously toward the surrounding crowd. Ediard did not turn around. His farsight revealed Gipalt, standing in the front row, feet apart and arms folded, a glower on his thin features. Contempt scudded across his surface thoughts, plain for everyone to sense. Ediard was adept enough to detect the currents of concern underneath. What's the water like? Baraka asked.
Cold, but very clear, Malzar said contentedly. Digging the well this close to the cliff is a boon. There is a lot of water filtering through the rock from above us, and it's wonderfully pure. No need to boil it before we make beer, eh? Got to be good news.
Ediard shuffled closer to the hole, half expecting Oberon's third hand to shove at him. His feet squelched on the semi-frozen mud around the flagstones, and he peered over the rim. Weddard had done a good job of lining the circular shaft. The stones were perfectly cut and were fixed better than a lot of cottage walls. This well would not crumble and collapse, as the last one had. Darkness lurked 10 feet below the rim like an impenetrable mist. His farsight probed down, reaching the water over 30 feet below ground level.
Are you ready? Malzar asked.
His voice was sympathetic. Without the Watermaster's support, the Council never would have allowed Ediard to try the cats.
Yes, sir.
Ediard, Akeem, Malzar, Baraka, and Weddard extended their third hands to lift the first cat off the wagon. All the people in the crowd used their farsight to follow it into the gloomy shaft. Just as it reached the water, Ediard tensed. Suppose it sinks.
And release, Akeem said so smoothly and confidently that Ediard had no alternative but to let go.
The cat bobbed about, completely unperturbed. Ediard realized he had been holding his breath. Anxiety scribbled across his mind for everyone to sense, especially Oberon. His relief was equally discernible to the villagers. It was not long before all 5 cats were floating on the water. Malzar lowered the thick rubber hose, unwinding it slowly from the cylinder it was spooled around. The end was remarkably complicated, branching many times as if it had sprouted roots. Ediard lay flat on the flagstones around the rim, heedless of the freezing mud soaking into his sweater. Warm air gusted up from the shaft to tickle his face. He closed his eyes, allowing himself to concentrate solely on his third hand as it connected the hose ends to the cat's gills. Simple muscle lips closed around the rubber tubes on his command, forming a tight seal. A standard Genistar cat had 3 big flotation bladders, giving it complete control over its own buoyancy as it swam, allowing it to float peacefully or dive down several yards. It was those bladders which Ediard had shaped the new cats around, expanding them to occupy 80% of the total body volume, surrounding them with muscle so that they were crude pumps, like a heart for water. His long talk ordered them to start the muscle squeeze sequence, building up an elementary rhythm. Everyone fell silent as he stood up. Eyes and farsight were focused on the giant stone trough that had been set up next to the well. The hose end curved over it. For an achingly long minute, nothing happened, and then it emitted a gurgling sound. Droplets of water spit out, the prelude to a foaming torrent that poured into the trough. It began to fill up remarkably quickly. Ediard remembered the flow of water from the old well pump. This had several times the pressure. Malzar dipped a cup into the water and tasted it.
Fresh and pure, he announced in a loud voice. And better than that, abundant.
He stood in front of Ediard and started clapping, his eyes ranging around the crowd, encouraging them. Others joined in. Soon Ediard was at the center of a storm of applause. His cheeks were burning again, but this time he didn't care. Akeem's arm went around his shoulder, his mind aglow with pride. Even Gipalt was acknowledging the success, albeit grudgingly. Of Oberon and his cronies there was no sign. There was the tidying up, of course. Sacks of the oily vegetable mush that the cats digested were filled and positioned beside the well, valves adjusted so that they dripped a steady supply down slender tubes. Ediard connected the far end of each tube to the mouth of a cat, instructing them to suckle slowly. Weddard and his apprentices fastened the hose to the side of the well. The ground was cleared. Finally, the huge stone capping slab was moved over the shaft, sealing the cats into their agreeable new milieu. By that time, apprentices and household G-monkeys were lining up at the trough with large pitchers.
You have a rare talent, my boy,
Malzar said as he watched the water lapping close to the top of the trough.
I see we're going to have to dig a drain to cope with the overspill. Then, no doubt, the council will soon be demanding that madcap pipe scheme to supply the houses. Quite a revolution you've started. Akeem, I'd be honoured if you and your apprentice would join us for our evening meal.
I will be happy to liberate some of the wine you hold prisoner, Akeem said. I've heard there are whole dungeons full under your guild hall.
Ha! Melzar turned to Ediard.
Do you like wine, my boy?
Ediard realized that the question was actually genuine. For once he wasn't simply being humoured.
I'm not sure, sir.
Best find out, then.
The crowd had departed, creating a rare atmosphere of satisfaction pervading the village. It was a good way to start the new spring season, ran the feeling, a good omen that times were getting better. Ediard stayed close to the trough as the apprentices filled their pitchers. He wasn't sure if he was imagining it, but they seemed to be treating him with a tad more approbation than before. Several even congratulated him.
Haunting the sight of your victory?
It was Selrana. He grinned at her.
Actually, just making sure the cats don't keel over from exhaustion or the hoses don't tear free. Stuff like that. There's a lot that can go wrong yet.
Poor Ediard. Always the pessimist.
Not today. Today was glorious.
He eyed the low clouds that were blocking the sun from view.
Helpful. For me and the village.
I'm really pleased for you, she exclaimed.
It takes so much courage to stand up for your own convictions, especially in a place like this.
Melzar was right. This is a revolution.
You were eavesdropping. What would the lady say?
She would say, well done, young man. This will make everyone's life a little better. Ashwell has one less thing to worry about now. The people need that. Life is so hard here. From small foundations of hope, empires can be built.
That has to be a quote, he teased.
If you attended church, you'd know.
I'm sorry. I don't get much time.
The lady knows and understands.
You're such a good person, Selrana. One day you'll be the Pythia, and you'll be mayor of Macathran.
What a grand time we'll have together, making all of Querentia a happy place.
No more bandits, no more drudgery, especially not for apprentices.
Or novices.
They'll talk about our reign until the Sky Lords return to carry us all into the heart.
Oh, look,
she squealed, and pointed excitedly at the trough.
It's overflowing. You've given us too much water, Ediard.
He watched as the water began to spill over the lip of the trough. Within seconds it had become a small stream frothing across the mud toward their feet. They both ran inside, laughing.
Chapter 2 Justine Bernelli examined her body closely before she put it on. After all, it had been over 2 centuries since she'd last worn it. During the intervening years, it had been stored in an exotic matter cage that generated a temporal suspension zone, so that barely half a second had passed inside. The cage looked like a simple sphere of violet light in ANA's New York reception facility, a building that extended 150 stories below Manhattan's streets. Her cage was housed on the 95th floor, along with several thousand identical radiant bubbles. ANA normally maintained a body for 5 years after the personality downloaded out of it, in case there were compatibility problems. Such an issue was unusual. Only about 1 in 11 million rejected a life inside ANA and returned to the physical realm. Once those 5 years were up, the body was discontinued. After all, if a personality really wanted to leave ANA after that, a simple clone could be grown. A process not dissimilar to the old-fashioned relife procedure that was still available in the external worlds. However, ANA governance considered it useful to have physical representatives walking the Greater Commonwealth in certain circumstances. Justine was one of them. It was partly her own fault. She had been over 800 years old when Earth had built its repository for advanced neural activity, the ultimate virtual universe where everyone supposedly was equal in the end. After so much life, she was very reluctant to see her body discontinued, in much the same way she'd never quite acknowledged that real life was true continuation. For her, clones, force-fed on a dead person's memories, were not the same person.
no matter that there was no discernible difference, that early 21st century upbringing of hers was too hard to shake off, even for someone as mature and controlled as she had become. The violet haze faded away to reveal a blonde girl in her biological mid-twenties. Rather attractive, Justine noted with a little tweak of pride, and very little of that had come from genetic manipulation down the centuries. The face she was looking at was still recognizable as the brattish party it girl of the early 21st century, who had spent a decade on the gossip channels as she dated her way through East Coast society and soap actors. Her nose had been reduced, admittedly, and pointed slightly. Now that she regarded it critically, it was possibly a little too cutesy, especially with cheekbones that looked like they were made from avian bone. They were so sharp, yet delicate. Her eyes had been modified to a pale blue, matching Nordic white skin that tanned to honey gold, and hair that was thick white blonde, falling below her shoulders. Her height was greater than her friends from the 21st century would have remembered. She'd surreptitiously added 4 inches during various rejuvenation treatments. Despite the temptation, she had not gained all that length only in her legs. She had made sure her torso was in proportion, with a nicely flat abdomen that was easy to maintain thanks to a slightly accelerated digestive system. Happily, she'd never gone for ridiculous boobs. Well, except that one time when she was rejuving for her 200th birthday, and did it to find out what it was like having a Grand Canyon cleavage. And yes, men did gape and come out with even more stupid opening lines, but as she could always have whoever she wanted anyway, there was no real advantage, and it wasn't really her. So she'd gotten rid of them at the next rejuvenation session. So there she was, in the flesh and still in good shape, just lacking a mind. With the monitor program confirming her visual review, she poured her consciousness back into her brain. The memory reduction was phenomenal, as was the loss of all the advanced thought routines that comprised her true personality these days. Her old biological neuron structure simply did not have the capacity to hold what she had become in ANA. It was like being lobotomized, actually feeling one's mind wither away to some primitive insect faculty. But only temporary, she told herself, so sluggishly. Justine drew her first breath in 200 years, her chest jerking down air as if she were waking from a nightmare. Her heart started racing. For a moment, she did nothing, not actually remembering what to do. Then the reliable old automatic reflexes kicked in. She drew another breath, getting a grip on her panic, overriding the old Neanderthal instincts with pure rationality. Another regular breath. Exo-images flickered into her peripheral vision, bringing up rows of default symbols from her enrichments. She opened her eyes. Long ranks of violet bubbles stretched out in all directions around her, like a bizarre artwork sculpture. Somehow her meat-based mind was convinced she could see the shapes of people inside. That was preposterous. Inside ANA, she'd obviously allowed herself to discard the memory of how fallible and hormone-susceptible a human brain was. A slow smile revealed perfect white teeth. At least I'll get to have some real sex before I download again. Justine teleported out of the New York reception facility right into the center of the Tulip Mansion. Stabilizer Fields had maintained the ancient Benelli family home through the centuries, keeping the building's fabric in pristine condition. She gave a happy grin when she saw it again with her own eyes. If she was honest with herself, it was a bit of a monstrosity, a mansion laid out in 4 petals, whose scarlet and black roofs curved up to a central tower stamen that had an apex anther made from a crown of carved stone coated in gold foil. It was as gaudy as it was striking, falling in and out of fashion over the decades. Justine's father, Gore Benelli, had bought the estate in Rye County just outside New York, establishing it as a base for the family's vast commercial and financial activities in the middle of the 21st century. It had remained a center for them while the Commonwealth was established, and had expanded outward until its social and economic uniformity was shattered by Bionics, ANA, and the separation of higher and advancer cultures. The family still had a prodigious business empire spread across the external worlds, but it was managed in a corporate structure by thousands of Bernellis, none of whom was over 300 years old. Gore and the original clique of close relatives, including Justine, who used to orchestrate it all, had long since downloaded into ANA, though Gore had never formally and legally handed over ownership to his impatient descendants. It was, he assured them, purely a quirk for their own benefit, ensuring that the whole enterprise could never be broken up, thus giving the family a cohesion that so many others lacked. Except Justine knew damn well that, even in his enlightened, expanded, semi-omnipotent state within ANA, Gore was not about to hand anything over he had spent centuries building up. Quirk, my ass. She had materialized in the middle of the mansion's ballroom. Her bare feet pressed down on a polished oak floor that was nearly as shiny as the huge gilt-edged mirrors on the wall. 100 reflections of her naked body grinned sheepishly back at her. Deep purple velvet drapes curved around the tall window doors that opened onto a veranda dripping with white wisteria. Outside, a bright, low February sun shone across the extensive wooded grounds with their massive swaths of rhododendrons. There had been some fabulous parties held in there, she recalled, with fame, wealth, glamour, power, notoriety, and beauty, mingling in a fashion that would have made Jane Austen green with envy. The doors were open, leading into the broad corridor. Justine walked through, taking in all the semi-familiar sights, welcoming the warm rush of recognition. Alcoves were filled with furniture that had been antique, even before Ozzy and Nigel had built their first wormhole generator. As for the artwork, one could buy a small continent on an external world with just one of the paintings. She padded up the staircase that curved through the entrance hall and made her way down the north petal to her old bedroom. Everything was as she'd left it, maintained for centuries by the stabilizer fields and maidbots. A comforting illusion that she or any other Bernelli could walk in at any time and be given a perfect greeting in his or her ancestral home. The bed was freshly made, with linen taken out of the stabilizer field and freshened as soon as she and ANA had agreed to the reception. Several items of clothing were laid out. She ignored the modern toga suit and went for a classical Indian-themed emerald dress with black boots. Very neutral. Justine jumped at the voice. Irritation quickly supplanted perturbation. She turned and glared at the solido standing in the doorway. Dad! I don't care how far past the physical you claim to be. You do not come into a girl's bedroom without knocking, especially mine. Gore Bernelli's image did not show much contrition. He simply watched with interest as she sat on the bed and laced up her boots. He had chosen the representation of his 24th century self, which was undoubtedly the image by which he was most known, a body whose skin had been turned to gold. Over that he wore a black V-neck sweater and black trousers. The perfect reflective surface made it difficult to determine his features. Without the gold sheen, he would have been a handsome 25-year-old with short-cropped fair hair. His face, which at the time he had had it done had been nothing more than merged organic circuitry tattoos, was all the more disconcerting thanks to the perfectly ordinary grey eyes peering out of the gloss. That Gore looked out on the world from behind a mask of improvements was something of a metaphor. He was a pioneer of enhanced mental routines, and had been one of the founders of ANA. "Like it matters," he grunted. "Politeness is always relevant," she snapped back. Her temper was not improved by the way her fingers seemed to lack dexterity. She was having trouble tying the bootlaces. "You were a good choice to receive the ambassador." She finally managed to finish the bow and lifted a quizzical eyebrow. "Are you jealous, Dad?" "Of becoming some kind of turbo version of a monkey again?" "Yeah, right. Thinking down at this level and this speed gives me a headache."
"Turbo monkey. You nearly said animal, didn't you?"
"Flesh and blood is animal."
"Just how many factions do you support?"
"I'm a conservative. Everyone knows that. Maybe a few campaign contributions to the outwards."
"Hmm." She gave him a suspicious look. Even in a body,
She knew the rumours that ANA gave a special dispensation to some of its internal personalities. ANA governance denied it, of course. But if anyone could manage to be more equal than others, it would be Gore, who had been there right at the start as one of the founding fathers. "The ambassador is nearly here," Gore said. Justine checked her exo-images and started to reorder her secondary thought routines. Her body's macrocellular clusters and bionics were centuries out of date, but perfectly adequate for the simple tasks this day would require. She called Casimir.
"I'm ready," she told him.
As she walked out of her bedroom, she experienced a brief chill that made her glance back over her shoulder. "That's the bed where we made love. The last time I saw him alive." Casimir McFoster was one memory she had never put into storage, never allowed to weaken. There had been others since, many others, both in the flesh and in ANA, wonderful, intense relationships, but none ever had the poignancy of dear Casimir, whose death had been her responsibility. Gore said nothing as his solido followed her down the grand staircase to the entrance hall. She suspected that he suspected. Casimir teleported into the marbled entrance hall, appearing dead center on the big Benelli crest. He was dressed in his admiral's tunic. Justine had never seen him wear anything else in 600 years. He smiled in genuine welcome and gave her a gentle embrace, his lips brushing her cheek. "Mother, you look wonderful as always." She sighed. He did look so like his father.
"Thank you, darling."
"Grandfather." He gave Gore a shallow bow. "Still holing up in that old receptacle, then?" Gore said. "When are you going to join us here in civilization?"
"Not today, thank you, grandfather."
"Dad, lay off," Justine warned. "It's goddamn creepy if you ask me," Gore grumbled. "No one stays in a body for 1,000 years. What's left for you out there?"
"Life, people, friends, true responsibility. A sense of wonder."
"We got a ton of that in here.
And while you look inward, the universe carries on around you.
Hey, we're very aware of extrinsic events,
which is why we're having this happy family reunion today."
Casimir gave a small victory smile. Justine wasn't listening to them anymore. They always ran through this argument as if it were a greeting ritual.
"Shall we go, boys?"
The doors of the mansion swung open, and she walked out onto the broad portico without waiting for the others. It was cold outside. Frost still was cloaking the deeper hollows in the lawn where the long shadows prevailed. A few clouds scudded across the fresh blue sky. Pushing its way through them was the Ockeson Empire ship, sliding in from the southeast. Roughly triangular, it was nearly 200 meters long. There was nothing remotely aerodynamic about it. The fuselage was a dark metal, mottled with aquamarine patches that resembled lichen. Its crinkled surface was crated with indentations that sprouted black spindles at the center, with long boxes that looked as though they had been welded on at random. A cluster of sharp radiator fins emerged from the rear section, glowing bright red. Gore gave a derisive chuckle. "What a monstrosity. You'd think they could do better now that we've given them regrav."
"We took 500 years to get from the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk to the Second Chance," Justine pointed out.
Gore looked up as the alien starship slowed to a halt above the mansion's grounds. "Do you think it'll have jets of dry ice gushing out when it lands? Or maybe they've mounted a giant laser gun that'll blast the White House to smithereens?"
"Dad, be quiet."
The ship descended. Two rows of hatches along its belly swung open. "For fuck's sake, haven't they even heard of malmetal?" Gore complained. Long fat landing legs telescoped out. The movement was accompanied by a sharp hissing sound, as high-pressure gas vented through grills on the undercarriage bays. Justine had to suck in her lower lip to stop herself from giggling. The starship was ridiculous, the kind of contraption Isambard Brunel would have built for Queen Victoria. It touched down on the lawn, its landing pad sinking deep into the grass and the soft soil. Several radiator fins sliced down into silver birch trees, their heat igniting the wood. Burning branches dropped to the ground.
"Wow,"
The damage it causes. How will our world survive? Quick, you kids, flee to the woods. I'll hold them off with a shotgun.
Dad, and cancel your solido. You know what the Empire thinks of ANA personalities.
Stupid and superstitious.
His solido vanished. Justine watched his icon appear in her exo-image. Now behave, she told him.
That ship is leaking radiation all over the place, Gore commented. They haven't even shielded their fusion reactor properly. And who uses deuterium anyway?
Justine reviewed the sensor data, scanning the ship's hotspots. It's hardly a harmful emission level. The Arkasans aren't as susceptible to radioactivity as humans are, Casimir said. It's one reason they were able to industrialize space in their home system with what equates to our mid-21st century technology. They simply didn't require the shielding mass we would have needed. Halfway down the starship's fuselage, a multi-segment airlock door unwound. The ambassador for the Arkasan Empire floated out, sitting on top of a hemispherical regrav sled. Physically, the alien was not impressive. A small barrel-shaped torso wrapped in layers of flaccid flesh that formed overlapping folds. Its four eyes were on serpent stalks, curving out from the crest, while four limbs were folded up against the lower half of its body. They were encrusted in cybernetic systems, amplifying its strength and providing a number of manipulator attachments that ranged from delicate pliers up to a big hydraulic crab pincer. Further support braces ran up its body, resembling a cage of chrome vertebrae that ended in a collar arrangement just below the base of the eye stalks. Patches of what looked like copper moss were growing across various sections of its flesh. They sprouted small rubbery stalks covered in minute sapphire flowers. Justine bowed formally as the sled stopped in front of her, floating half a meter off the ground, which put the ambassador's eye stalks above her. Even with the regrav unit and the physical support, it was obvious the ambassador had come from a low-gravity world. It sagged against the metal and composite structures holding it up. Two of the eye stalks bent around so that they were aligned on her.
Ambassador, thank you for visiting us, Justine said.
We are pleased to visit, the ambassador answered, its voice a whispery burble coming from a slender vocalizer gill between the eye stalks.
Translated into English, the sled processors used a speaker on the rim to boom the reply to Justine.
My home welcomes you, she said, remembering the formalities.
Another of the ambassador's eye stalks curved around to stare at Casimir.
You are the human navy, Commander.
That is correct, Casimir said. I am here as you requested.
Many of my nest ancestor cousins fought in the Fandola assault.
Thin droplets of spittle ran out of the ambassador's gill to be absorbed by drain holes in its support collar.
I am sure they fought with honor.
Honor be damned! We would have enjoyed victory over the Hancha vermin if you had not intervened that day.
We are friends with the Hancha. Your attack was ill-advised. I warned you we would not abandon our friends. That is not our way.
The fourth eye stalk turned on Casimir.
You in person warned the Empire, Navy Commander?
That is correct.
You live so long. You are no longer natural.
Is this why you are here, Ambassador? To insult me?
You overreact. I state the obvious.
We do not hide from the obvious, Justine said, but we are not here today to dwell upon what was. Please, come in, Ambassador.
You are kind.
Justine walked into the entrance hall with the Ambassador's sled gliding along behind her. Somehow it managed to keep a distance that was not so close as to be blatantly rude, but close enough to be disconcerting. Casimir's icon blinked up beside Gore's in her peripheral vision.
You know, he said, the Arkasans only started painting their sleds black after they found out humans are unsettled by darkness.
If that's the best they can come up with, it's a wonder their species ever survived the fission age, she replied.
We shouldn't be in too much of a hurry to mock them, Gore replied. However much we sneer, they do have an empire, and they would have obliterated the Hanshire if we hadn't stepped in.
I'd hardly consider that to be an indicator of their superiority, Justine told them, and they're certainly not a threat to us. Their technology level is orders of magnitude below higher culture, let alone ANA.
Yes, but right now they only have one policy, to acquire better technology, especially weapons technology. A sizable percentage of the Emperor's expansion budget is diverted to building long-range exploration ships in the hope they'll come across a world whose inhabitants have gone post-physical and they can help themselves to whatever's left behind.
Let's hope they never encounter a prime immotile.
They've made 17 attempts to reach the Dyson pair, Casimir told her, and they currently have 42 ships searching for an immotile civilization beyond the region of space we firewalled.
I didn't know that. Is there any danger they'll find a rogue prime planet?
If we can't find one, they certainly won't be able to. Justine led their little party into the MacLeod room and sat at the head of the large oak table running down the middle. Casimir took the chair at his mother's side while the ambassador hovered at the other end. Its eye stalks bent around slowly, as if it were having trouble with what it saw as it scanned the walls. The room's decor was Scottish-themed, surrounding the alien with tartan drapes, ancient Celtic ceremonial swords, and solemn marble mannequins dressed in clan kilts. Several sets of bagpipes were displayed in glass cases. A fabulous pair of stag antlers hung above the stone mantel that had been imported from a Highland castle.
Ambassador, Justine said formally, I represent the human government of Earth.
I am physical, as you asked, and I am empowered to negotiate on the government's behalf with the Arcasan Empire.
What do you wish to discuss?
Three of the ambassador's eyes curved around to stare at her.
Although we disapprove of living creatures placing themselves subordinate to the mechanical, we consider your planetary computer to be the true ruler of the Commonwealth. That is why I required this direct meeting rather than with the Senate, as usual.
Justine was not about to start arguing about political structures with an alien who saw everything in black and white. ANA has considerable influence beyond this planet.
That is so. Then you must work with the Empire to avert a very real danger.
What danger is that, Ambassador?
As if none of us knew. A human organization is threatening to send ships into the void.
Yes, our living dream movement wants to send its followers on a pilgrimage there.
I am familiar with human emotional states after being exposed to your kind for so long, so I am curious why you do not react to this event with any sense of distress or concern. It is through humans that we know of the void. Therefore you know what effect your living dream is proposing to trigger.
They do not propose anything. They simply wish to live the life of their idol.
You are deliberately denying the implication. Their entry to the void will provoke a massive devourment phase. The galaxy will be ruined. Our empire will be consumed. You will kill us and countless others.
That will not happen, Justine said.
We are reassured that you intend to stop the living dream.
That's not what I said. It is not our belief that their pilgrimage will cause a devourment phase of any size. They simply do not possess the ability to pass through the event horizon which guards the void. Even the Rael have trouble doing that, and Living Dream does not have access to a Rael ship.
Then why are they launching this pilgrimage?
It is a simple political gesture. Nothing more. Neither the Arcasan Empire nor any other species in the galaxy has anything to worry about.
Do you guarantee that your living dream group cannot get through the event horizon? Other humans have crossed over into the void. They are the cause of this desire to pilgrimage, are they not?
Nothing is certain, Ambassador. You know that. But the likelihood,
if you cannot guarantee it,
Then you must prevent the ships from flying. The Greater Commonwealth is a democratic institution, complicated in this case by Living Dream being both Transstellar and the legitimate government of Elezalin. The Commonwealth Constitution is specifically designed to protect every member's right to self-determination on an individual and governmental level. In other words, we don't actually have the legal right to prevent them from embarking on their pilgrimage.
I am familiar with human lawyers. Everything can be undone. Nothing is final. You play with words, not reality. The Empire recognizes only power and ability. Your computer government has the physical power to prevent this pilgrimage. Am I not correct?
Ability does not automatically imply intent, Justine said. ANA governance has the ability to do many things. We do not do them because of the laws which govern us, both legal and moral.
It is not part of your morality to destroy this galaxy. You can prevent this.
We can argue strongly against it, she said, wishing she did not agree quite so much with the Ockerson.
The Empire requires a tangible commitment. The pilgrimage ships must be neutralized.
Out of the question, Justine said. We cannot interfere with the lawful activities of another sovereign state. It goes against everything we are.
If you do not prevent the launch of this atrocity, then the Empire will. Even your lawyers will agree we have the right to species self-preservation.
Is that a threat, Ambassador? Casimir asked quietly.
It is the course of action you have forced upon us. Why do you not see this? Are you afraid of your primitive cousins? What can they threaten you with?
They do not threaten us. We respect each other. Can you make the leap to understand that?
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.